This is what I'm proposing here, Jared. We didn't cross the line when we started using tools. Chimpanzees use tools. We crossed the line when we became hunters. Our non-human ancestors were toolmakers and users, but they weren't hunters because they didn't have the mental equipment to be hunters. In other words, we became human by hunting. And of course, we became hunters by becoming human. And by the way, hunting is not an exclusively male activity among Aboriginal peoples of today, so there's no reason to suppose it was an exclusively male activity among our earliest human ancestors. Excuse me, I hope this won't sound like an inquisitorial question, but it sounds like you're saying that we hunted before we were hunters. How can you hunt before you're a hunter? How can you fly before you're a flyer, Jared? By gliding. Even the most primitive tracking ability will give you a slight edge over those who don't have it, and any slight edge tends to increase your representation in the gene pool. As the hunter's representation in the gene pool increases, the behavior spreads. And in each generation, the best hunters, even if they're well below modern standards, will have an edge and will tend to be better represented in the gene pool. In other words, hunting ability, which in humans doesn't mean speed or power, but rather intelligence, was the vector for natural selection in the case of human evolution. Intelligence of a human order wasn't just a lucky accident. It didn't evolve just so we could have beautiful thoughts. It seems like language would have had a role in all this. Of course it did. I told you we became human when we developed a new lifestyle. Non-human primates make their living by foraging, but foraging doesn't require much communication. A band of primates can settle into an area and begin foraging without any planning or coordination or cooperation or allotment of tasks. They just move in and everybody starts munching. But this sort of behavior won't work for primate hunters. You can't just move in and have everybody start hunting. Hunting teamwork is what pays off. But in primates, no hunting teamwork is genetically wired in the way it is with wolves or hyenas. In primates, hunting teamwork can only come about through communication. So you're saying language developed as an adjunct to hunting. Language developed because it conferred advantages. It didn't have to confer only one advantage. Language ability made you valuable as a hunting partner, therefore it also made you valuable as a mate. Language ability meant you were both more likely to survive and more likely to reproduce. It seems to me that language and hunting develop reciprocally then. And if that's the case, then we became human not just by hunting, but by hunting and talking. You're not contradicting me, though you seem to think you are. You're just anticipating me. I can't say everything at once. Again, she patted the ground in front of us. I said there were several things I wanted you to take from this demonstration. The first is that we became human by reading the signs, and of course by talking. We didn't become human by banging on rocks or by making up sonnets. Intelligence invited us to explore a new lifestyle based on hunting and foraging rather than just foraging alone. This new lifestyle demanded and rewarded new forms of communication and cooperation. Here is the second thing I want you to take from this demonstration. There will inevitably be people who imagine that I'm offering a rationale for human violence. Nothing could be further from my mind. In the first place, no special rationale is needed for humans because humans are not remarkably or unusually violent. Outside of our own culture, which represents a tiny, tiny fraction of humanity, outside of our culture, humans are violent in the same circumstances that other species are typically violent, in establishing and defending territory. Outside of this one deranged culture of ours, we humans are not more violent than other species. And it wasn't hunting that made us as violent as we are. Our foraging ancestors were just as violent. Non-hunters are just as violent. Vegetarian species are just as violent. Nor are we the only species whose members visit violence on each other. Nothing could be further from the truth. Aside from predation, virtually all violence observed in the biological community is intraspecies violence. I can't explain everything here all at once, so you'll have to follow up on this on your own if you're interested. There will be people who will take what I'm saying and make out of it an endorsement of sport hunting. Again, nothing could be further from my mind. The fact that humans evolved as hunters didn't implant in them an irresistible urge to slaughter wildlife. The successful hunter isn't the one with the most bloodlust. Bloodlust is not required, is irrelevant. Watch hunters in the wild, and you'll see this. They don't go about their business frothing at the mouth, and they don't kill gratuitously. Let me put it this way. The trait that was being saved as we evolved as human hunters was not murderousness. It was a talent for observation, deduction, forecasting, cunning, stealth, and alertness. These are the qualities that make for success as a hunter. And they're not at all specific to hunting. If they were, then we would indeed be irresistibly impelled to hunt. But there are things that we're irresistibly impelled to do, and you can see them here. She patted the ground in front of her. Tell me what happened here, in this spot, a few hours ago, Jared.
Well, a beetle came walking along. Then a mouse leaped out of the grass at the left and made a grab at the beetle.
You said these marks looked like marks of a scuffle, but I don't know why a mouse would have to scuffle with a beetle. Maybe the beetle grabbed back.
True.
Anyway, after the scuffle, the mouse carried the beetle off to the right.
You understand that this, what you've just done, is totally beyond the capacity of any other animal on this planet?
Yes.
What exactly did you do?
Well, I took a scattering of information and put it together into a story.
Exactly.
Bee patted the ground in front of her. Here is where we became human, Jared. This is where the temporal structure of the universe began to be imprinted on the human brain. These tracks in front of us are, of course, with us in the present, but they won't make any sense until we recognize them as traces of past events. They would be useless to any other species because no other species would be able to read them as traces of the past.
Isn't this what a dog does with a scent?
No, not at all. Sitting here, you and I are releasing a physical emanation of ourselves into the air. This scent, this physical emanation, extends all the way back to the car, and a dog encountering it there could easily follow it here. But it wouldn't be reading the past, it would be reading the present. It would be following its nose to us, just the way you might follow your ears to an outdoor concert blocks away.
Yes, I see the distinction.
To return to the traces on this patch of ground before us, in order to make sense of them, you not only have to recognize that they're traces of past events, you have to recognize that they have a direction in time, beginning, middle, and end. The beetle story begins here, progresses to here, and ends there, where it intersects the mouse's story. We can see that the mouse's story continues into a future that we can make predictions about. Sometime last night, a mouse was here, and now it's gone, headed that away. If we follow those tracks, we know we're eventually going to find something standing in those tracks. And that something is going to be what?
A mouse.
A mouse, Jared. That we have never laid our eyes on until that moment. You see what I'm saying? Sitting right here, we've gained the capacity to foretell the future. We've become seers. A few minutes ago, I said that our hunting gene doesn't give us an irresistible urge to slaughter wildlife, but it does give us another irresistible urge, which is the urge to know what we're going to encounter on that track ahead of us. Each and every one of us wants to know the future by any means, whatever, rational or irrational, sensible or fantastic. This is so deeply ingrained in us, so much taken for granted, that we don't give a moment's thought to how remarkable it is. It would be hard for us even to imagine an intelligent species that wasn't obsessed with the future. And perhaps a species that wasn't obsessed with the future could never seem fully intelligent to us at all. Beyond all the presumably rational planning each of us does as a matter of course, every single one of us is a reader of omens and signs, no matter how much we poo-poo it. When we get up in the morning and the newspaper on the lawn is soaked and the milk in our cereal is sour and the shirt we intended to wear is in the laundry and the car won't start, there's not one of us who can avoid thinking this is going to be a rotten day. There's not one of us who can pick a winner at the track without thinking, I knew it. Because we were born as hunters, we have a genetic craving to know where the track leads and what lies at the end of it. We have an appetite for the future that's as persistent as our appetite for food or sex. To say that it's genetic is, of course, to propose a theory, but again, I see nothing implausible in it. The hunter who's not only hungry but avid to know the future is certainly going to have an edge over the hunter who's just hungry. Yes, I'd have to think so. If I won't interrupt your train of thought, I'd like to tell you about something that happened to me once that seems relevant to what you're saying. You can decide if it's relevant. Okay. I remember once in college, in a game of five-card draw poker, being dealt the card I needed to fill an inside straight flush. Getting that card was definitely a religious experience. It was like a transfiguration. I expected everyone at the table to be blinded by the divine effulgence that was radiating from me. This seems very relevant indeed to me. When you call it a religious experience, are you being facetious? Not at all. I suppose it was the kind of experience called oceanic. I was in a state of cosmic transcendence. I felt that the universe in that moment had taken notice of me. I was in touch with the fountainhead of meaning and being. A religious experience, but presumably not a Christian experience. No, not a Christian experience. This oceanic feeling you describe has often been conjectured to be the source of the religious impulse, but only B traces that oceanic feeling to this patch of ground here in front of us with its beetle scratchings and mouse scratchings. This is where we first began to reach into a dimension beyond the ken of any other creature on Earth, a dimension that is surely not our own domain, but if we can imagine it to be anyone's domain, then whose must it be? It must be the domain of the gods. To flip a coin and bet on heads is to enter the domain of the gods. To draw a card to a four-card straight flush is to enter the domain of the gods. To read the marks on this patch of earth and begin a hunt is to enter the domain of the gods. And when the coin turns up heads, when the fifth card fills your straight flush, and when the hunt succeeds, it doesn't matter whether you believe in one god, a thousand gods, or no gods at all. You know that the universe has taken notice of you, that you've been in touch with the fountainhead of meaning and being. Now you understand, or at least I hope you understand, what I meant about the harmonic I was talking about yesterday. I said that when mental process crossed the border and became human thought, perhaps thought itself began to resound with a harmonic that corresponds to what we call religion or awareness of the sacred. Yes. At the time, I had no idea what you were getting at. I thought it very unlikely that you'd ever be able to persuade me of such a thing. And now? And now it makes sense. Human thought is thought that opens up into the future. And the future is inescapably the domain of the gods. Crossing the border, you can't help but meet them. And you're in a position now to understand the universality of the animist experience, to understand why there once was a universal religion on this planet. It doesn't matter where you cross the border and meet those gods, the experience is the same. The African experience is not different from the Asian, or the European, or the Australian, or the American. Every hunt begins here, and is pursued into the domain of the gods. No one would ever think of saying that a duck or an earthworm is close to nature. And it's similarly true that our animist ancestors were not close to nature, they were nature, were a part of the general community of life. They belonged to that community as fully as moths and skunks and lizards belong to it. As fully, and I might add, as thoughtlessly. I mean, they didn't congratulate themselves for belonging to it. They took it for granted.
The same is true of modern lever peoples. They don't belong to this community of life as a matter of principle, or because they think it's right or noble or good for the children or good for the planet. I point this out to drag my feet against the current tendency to angelize them, which I personally think is no better than demonizing them the way our great-grandparents did. They don't need to be angelized. They do indeed have a lifestyle that's healthier for people and healthier for the planet, but they don't hold on to it because they're noble. They hold on to it for the best reason in the world, because they prefer it to ours, and would rather be dead than live the way we do. All the same, living in the community of life did give them something we've lost, which is a complete understanding of where we come from. Children in our culture think that life comes to us from our human parents, and that food is just another product we manufacture, like paint or plastic or glass. Children in hunting-gathering cultures know that life doesn't come to us only from our parents. It comes to us just as truly from all the living things we subsist on. These plants and animals aren't products any more than we are. And if we live in the hand of the God, then so do they, in exactly the same way. She shook her head, obviously dissatisfied. There are some things pros just can't handle, Jared. Let me address this to Louis. She closed her eyes. The people I learned the law of life from, Louis, are the people who actually gave the law that name. The Ihalmiut Eskimos, who lived in the Great Barrens of Canada inside the Arctic Circle. Theirs was a strange life by our standards, but its strangeness makes it very easy for us to comprehend. The Ihalmiut were the people of the deer. They were this because deer was what they lived on. They were completely dependent on the deer, because other animals were rare, and vegetation that's edible by humans is practically non-existent inside the Arctic Circle. It's hard to imagine living entirely on meat. Never a piece of bread, never a piece of chocolate, never a banana or a peach or an ear of corn. But they did, and were perfectly healthy and happy. They'd never have to explain who and what they were to their own children, but if they did, they'd say something like this. We know you look at us and call us men and women, but this is only our appearance, for we're not men and women. We're deer. The flesh that grows on our bones is the flesh of deer, for it's made from the flesh of the deer we've eaten. The eyes that move in our heads are the eyes of deer, and we look at the world in their stead and see what they might have seen. The fire of life that once burned in the deer now burns in us, and we live their lives and walk in their tracks across the hand of God. This is why we're the people of the deer. The deer aren't our prey or our possessions, they're us. They're us at one point in the cycle of life, and we're them at another point in the cycle. The deer are twice your parents, for your mother and father are deer, and the deer that gave you its life today was mother and father to you as well, since you wouldn't be here if it weren't for that deer. She opened her eyes and glanced at me, a signal, I assume, that she was once again addressing me rather than her son. Lillian Hellman once said something that surprised me. Nothing you write will ever come out the way you hoped it would. Not her exact words, but something like that. It surprised me, because I thought, hey, you're in complete control of what goes on the page, so why shouldn't it come out the way you want? I suppose the answer is that what we hope to achieve is always beyond human power. We want to make the earth tremble, and the stones weep, and the skies open up. I wanted to do this for you here, right now, but I know I haven't. For a moment, I almost thought this was an odd sort of ambition for anyone to have. Then I remembered myself as a young man. My own ambitions had not been so different, but they'd grown dry and insubstantial, and the winds and rains of time had eroded them to almost nothing. I said I was going to be selective in what I revealed to you about the lever lifestyle. So you'd be able to articulate the animist vision as easily as you were able to articulate our own vision.
I remember.
I told you this little patch of dirt here in front of us is where it all begins. Human thought, human awareness of the sacred, and human history. But as many times as I've come back to it, I don't think I've ever been completely forthright with you. I've been diffident. And I'm going to have to put aside this diffidence right now. An hour ago, I don't know if you'll remember it, I told you we became human reading the tale of events written here, here in the hand of the god. And I showed you my own hand, like this. Do you know what I meant by that?
I'm not sure.
Do you see these marks in my hand?
Of course.
I'm comparing them to these marks left by the beetle and the mouse. Both sets of marks are tracks, marks left by the passage of life. It's my notion, and of course it's just a notion, that these tracks found here in the hand and here on the ground gave rise to the notion that we live in the hand of the god of this place.
She reached out and dragged her forefinger across the track of the beetle.
Shirin's mark. Like the beetle and the mouse, once upon a time, I was here. And if another comes to study these marks, he or she will say, all three were here at different times, all held in the hand of the god, and all still held in the hand of the god, though they're no longer right here. Every track begins and ends in the hand of God. And every track is a lifetime long. Hunter and hunted are both standing in their tracks when they meet. And there are no tracks, however far flung, that fall outside the hand of God. All paths lie together, like a web endlessly woven, and yours and mine are no greater or less than the beetles or the mouses. All are held together. These are things I'd like to say to Louis. We make our journey in the company of others. The deer, the rabbit, the bison, and the quail walk before us. And the lion, the eagle, the wolf, the vulture, and the hyena walk behind us. All our paths lie together in the hand of God. And none is wider than any other or favored above any other. The worm that creeps beneath your foot is making its journey across the hand of God as surely as you are. Remember that your tracks are one strand of the web woven endlessly in the hand of God. They're tied to those of the mouse in the field, the eagle on the mountain, the crab in its hole, the lizard beneath its rock. The leaf that falls to the ground 1,000 miles away touches your life. The impress of your foot in the soil is felt through 1,000 generations. I'm at the end of my strength for now, Jared, but I want to take one more field trip before we call it a day. This will be a mental one, so you won't have to put on your Natty Bumppo hat. I grew up out in the Great Plains, Jared, but it's not all cornfields, even today. I want you to travel with me to a place I remember as a child, a plains wilderness. Once when I was a kid, I remember watching an old Western movie on TV called The Sea of Grass. I don't know what it was about. All I remember is one scene where Spencer Tracy looks out over this vast sea of grass, stretching from horizon to horizon, and the winds stirring it up and sending it into waves just like the sea. The place I'm talking about wasn't as huge as that, but it was the same kind of place. Close your eyes and see if you can picture such a place. The important thing to realize is that this isn't grass, Jared. This is deer and bison and sheep and cicadas and moles and rabbits. Reach down and grab a handful. Go ahead, at least mentally. Have you got it? That's a mouse. And the mouse, the ox, the gazelle, the goat, and the beetle all burn with the fire of grass, Jared.
Grass is their father and mother, and their young are grass. One thing, grass and grasshopper. One thing, grasshopper and sparrow. One thing, sparrow and fox. One thing, fox and vulture. One thing, Jared. And its name is fire, burning today as a stalk in the field, tomorrow as a rabbit in its burrow, and the next day as an 11-year-old girl named Sheeran. The vulture is fox, the fox grasshopper, the grasshopper rabbit, the rabbit girl, the girl grass. All together, we're the life of this place, indistinguishable from one another, intermingling in the flow of fire, and the fire is God. Not the creator of the universe, but the animator of this single place. To each of us is given its moment in the blaze, Jared, its spark to be surrendered to another when it's sent, so that the blaze may go on. None may deny its spark to the general blaze and live forever, not any at all, certainly not me, for all my giant intellect. Each is sent to another someday. You are sent, Jared. Louis, you're on your way, both of you. I, too, am sent to the wolf, or the cougar, or the vulture, or the beetles, or the grasses. I am sent. I'm sent, and I thank you all, grasses in all your forms, fire in all your forms, sparrows and rabbits and mosquitoes and butterflies and salmon and rattlesnakes, for sharing yourselves with me for this time. And I'm bringing it all back, every last atom paid in full, and I appreciate the loan. My death will be the life of another, Jared. I swear that to you. And you watch, you come find me, because I'll be standing again in these grasses, and you'll see me looking through the eyes of the fox, and taking the air with the eagle, and running in the track of the deer. These are our secret teachings, Jared. I know Charles told you that secret teachings are ones that teachers have a hard time giving away. Do you see now why this is so? Yes. The lever peoples of the world have been trying to tell you these things for centuries, and yet they remain secrets. Certainly Charles and I haven't hidden them. Far from it. Real secrets can be kept by publishing them on billboards. By this time we were walking back to the car. B said, "When we began this process, you offered this as the taker vision. The world was made for man, and man was made to conquer and rule it. Have I given you enough to articulate the lever or animist vision?" "I think so." We walked on, and thankfully she didn't prompt me. Finally, as the street came in sight, I paused and said, "This is the best I can do. It doesn't seem very elegant to me." "It won't cause the ground to tremble." "No, nor will the stones weep or the heavens open up." "I know what you mean, Jared. I really do." "The world is a sacred place and a sacred process," I told her. "And we're part of it." "That's excellent, Jared. Simple and to the point. This is what was understood and is still understood among lever peoples. Wherever you went in the world, you found people who took it for granted that the world is a sacred place and that we belong in that sacred place as much as any other creature in the world." Smiling, she looked around the park as if giving it a silent farewell. Then she included me in the smile as she said, "Maybe someday, someone will find a way to say it that makes the ground tremble." About halfway back to the hotel, I said, "You were going to tell me what Charles had in mind with the ammonite fossil he gave me." "Oh, yes," she said, then pulled over and parked. "Charles was much better than I am with this aspect of things. He would have sat you down and made you see how past, present, and future were woven together at that little patch of ground. He would have shown you that you really could read the future from the signs you saw there. Nothing magical. As I said myself, we're all involved in reading the future all the time. He was fond of pointing out that the genes that make us hunters still make tales of mystery and detection irresistible to us.
What does this have to do with a fossil?
Where is it?
I dug it out and handed it to her.
I suspect he planned to ask you the future of this fossil, which is at least 60 million years older than the human race. That's an awful lot of its past that you know. What do you know of its future?
Nothing at all. She laughed and shook her head. I'm sure he could have predicted that answer without any difficulty. I'm sure he could, I said, a bit miffed.
Come on, she said, getting out and going round to the trunk, where she took out a tire iron and handed it to me.
What am I supposed to do with this?
She walked over to the curb, sat down, and when I joined her, she set the fossil between us and told me to smash it to bits.
I won't, I told her, just stating a fact.
No, go ahead.
I won't, I told her again. Why do you want me to do that?
I want to show you how to read the future, she said, half laughing, it seemed to me.
I picked up the fossil, returned the tire iron to the trunk, and got back in the car.
Charles would have done it better, she said as we drove off. The point of the exercise needs to be more fully developed.
I snorted contemptuously.
Charles would have got you to smash it.
Pah, I said, unable to think of anything better. Bee laughed. To me, in my besotted state, a sweeter sound than bird song. I told B not to expect me at the theater tonight, which is just as well, since it took me till 11 o'clock to finish the foregoing. I'm now going to go down to the bar, have a couple of drinks, and think about absolutely nothing for an hour. Then, for a very great change, I'm going to have a normal night's sleep. Tomorrow night, Sheeran addresses the public as B for the first time. I'm frankly fascinated to know how it'll turn out.
Date unknown. Place unknown. They tell me I'm in a hospital. They tell me I've been here 3 days. They tell me I have a concussion. They tell me bruised ribs hurt more than broken ribs. They tell me I was in an explosion. They tell me the theater exploded. They tell me the reason for the explosion is unknown. They tell me it's buried under a zillion tons of rubble. They tell me it was probably a gas explosion. They tell me it happened around 6 in the evening. They tell me the theater was empty at the time. They tell me no one ever lived there. They tell me this is a ridiculous idea. They tell me they won't dig up a zillion tons of rubble. They tell me no bodies would be found. They tell me no one has been reported missing. They tell me no one has tried to visit me. They tell me no one has called except Father Lufra. They tell me I talked to him the day after the explosion. They tell me I forgot this because I have a concussion. They tell me I talked to him yesterday. They tell me I forgot this because I have a concussion. They tell me this condition will almost certainly pass. They tell me I may someday remember the explosion. They tell me I may never remember the explosion. They tell me I'll fly home as soon as I'm strong enough. They tell me I may be strong enough day after tomorrow. They tell me all my belongings are in the closet. They tell me they brought them from my hotel room. They tell me all my notebooks are intact. They tell me I shouldn't be looking at them now. They tell me I shouldn't be writing in them now. They tell me I shouldn't be getting excited now. They tell me I shouldn't be worrying now. They tell me I shouldn't be thinking now. They tell me I should be resting now. They tell me I should be taking it easy now. They tell me it's time for an injection. I tell them I need to keep my notebook. They tell me my notebook will not get lost. I tell them I need to remember what I've written here. They tell me it'll be right here when I wake up. They give me the injection. I start taking it easy. Date unknown, place unknown. It appears that this was actually written by me.
Date unknown, place unknown. I, Jared Osborne, write this down for Jared Osborne, for when you wake up in the middle of the night, as you seem to do, and you don't know where the hell you are. The preceding pages, beginning, "They tell me I'm in a hospital," were also written by me for when you wake up in the middle of the night, but I don't remember writing them any more than I will remember writing this the next time I wake up in the middle of the night and find it sitting on the table beside the bed.
Date unknown, place unknown. This is concussion. That's what you have to get fixed firmly in your head. You have a concussion. And for the time being, your long-term memory is out to lunch. We hope it's for the time being. All of us Jareds who read and write in this notebook, the doctors who patiently tell us their names every day and that we regularly forget every day, assure us that very probably this is a temporary condition. May 31, among my Laurentian brethren. Apparently I sleep a great deal. I have no idea whether it's for hours or for days. Now when I wake up, I reach automatically for this notebook. I don't remember what's in it, but I do remember that it has the answers. I think the idea is, even if my long-term memory never returns, this notebook can serve as a kind of cumulative record. I've collected a lot of information in the last hour, which I should put down here. To begin with, I'm back in the United States. I'm at what seminarians used to call the company farm, which is where you go when you need a little rest, or a little vacation from booze, or the whispers about you and the altar boys are beginning to get a bit noisy. All the big orders have them, of course. Some of them have several thoughtfully specialized. Naturally, they're not called penitentiaries anymore. Nowadays, they're called retreat centers. This one is located in the rolling countryside, about 100 miles south of St. Jerome's. I found this out by picking up the phone on my bedside table. Apparently, I always do this. Tim, the young man who answered, I don't know that he's young, but he sounds young, told me to read the entries in my notebook, and I told him I'd already done that. And then he told me where I was, that I'd been here for 2 days, that it was 2 o'clock in the morning, evidently my favorite time for calling, May 31. What he calls the accident happened on Sunday, the day after Sheeran was scheduled to speak at the theater. Tim knows nothing whatever about the explosion, except that I was pulled out of the rubble and lucky to be alive. I asked him how to get an outside line and was told I'd have to talk to Dr. Emerson about that. I asked him what other kinds of patients are in this ward, and he said I'd have to ask Dr. Emerson a question like that. I asked him if I could come talk to him, and he said this would not be a good idea.